Welcome to part two of Mike Dolinsky's Stuff You Should Know webinar series. Thank you for joining us again. If you have not watched part one of this webinar series, please take the time to view it now. Buckle up for part two. It's a little shorter than the first one, and in this webinar, Mike will dive deep into the stress responses of canola, wheat, and peas. I hope you all take advantage of the benefits of pre-recorded content. Feel free to pause, rewind, and rewatch as you need. These topics are not for the faint of heart. Mike and I will be hosting a live question and answer on Friday, February 12th at 11 a.m. Saskatchewan time. That's 10 for Mike in Alberta. It will also be recorded and available for rewatch. If you have questions that come up as you watch either of these webinars, please do not hesitate to forward them to one of us ahead of time. My email is gkendall@southcountry.ca, or you can present them live in the question and answer. Without further delay, I will let Mike take it away and share with us part two of this webinar series.
Are we rolling?
We're rolling.
Okay, I got to shrink you here, I guess, eh? There we go. Oops, I see you. I don't see
you. Go to your share screen.
My share screen.
Along the bottom.
See, mine doesn't pop up once I'm into the darn thing. You may have to do it again.
Just take your time and I'll just edit this little chunk out.
Yeah, okay. So I got to get out of here then. But nothing now. Oops.
Should be just like if you scroll to the bottom of our pictures and go share screen.
Okay, you're doing a share screen again? So let's join meeting. What's happened here?
So do you see our pictures? Are you looking at both of us on your screen?
Hold it. I'm having something's going on here. It says join meeting again and I can't. What's going on here?
You don't want to do that.
Joel, just wait, go back here. Launch meeting, shit. Open it. I'm going all the way back. There we go. Okay. So I see. Ready, share screen. Okay. There it is.
Yeah.
Okay, there we are.
Okay, beautiful. Now, yeah.
Now, everything is perfect. Don't touch anything.
Fire away, Mike.
Okay, I'll just put me here. There. Oh, that's you. Okay, good. How do I get rid of you?
The button, you can go hide participants.
I hide you. Doesn't matter. You can stay there. Oh, I see. There's a mute button there. That's where I probably hit it before.
Yeah.
Okay. We're good to go. You can see my screen clean.
I can see you perfect.
Okay. Here we go. Well, welcome back to part two. This is going to be a little bit shorter, but I think it's just as important or maybe more important because this is talking about what you can do. And if you look in the background, you can see this leaf here, this canola leaf, which is typical as you drive across the prairies in the late evening when it's dry. You see these leaves spun over and wilting like this, and then you come back in the morning and root pressure has reloaded them. This is a mechanical process that leaves use in cereals. They roll up and in broadleaf reeds they're turned over to reduce their exposure to the sunshine. But let's get going here. This picture shows up a lot when anybody's talking about stress management and plants, and it's probably the only one that I see. But it tells you a story. It tells you a story that abiotic stress is something we have very little control on, and it's a bigger impact on crop yield than biotic. We've done a good job of dealing with microbes, with fungi, with all those kind of root organisms and, you know, bugs, insects that are chewing them down. And it's in fact the abiotic stress, those heat, salinity, drought, cold situations that are the problem. So, you know, I want to, before we get into actually how we tackle it, I want to provide a bit of an introduction to what I think is going on in some of the issues that we got to look at here very seriously. Here's some information on nutrient density, a 40-year change in nutrient density of wheat over 40 years. And pretty well all of them are down. And we can take a look at some important ones. The potassium levels aren't that bad, and the phosphorus aren't, but they're down 15%. Iron's down, copper's down, zinc is down, and that is to 2003. What has happened since 2003? We've been farming this land for 100 plus years. Since 2003, we have taken yields up big time and acreage that have been put into canolas massively. And I want to spend some time looking at some of this stuff. Here's a results out of A&L Lab for 2020 season for Western Canada, just published. And it tells us something. 66% of samples were low to very low in phosphorus, 78 for sulfur, 37 for boron, 55 for zinc. And you heard from my first presentation that these are all really, really important. And if we're going to have homeostasis in plants and everything there for them to function properly, this is not a good outline for that happening, to tell you the honest truth. And what have we just had happen this year? Price of phosphorus has gone through the roof. You've had a good crop last year, pull down your phosphorus, and now you're looking at putting it back. And I can just about guarantee many guys aren't going to put back what they took out. Some of Southern Alberta had the best crop they've had in their lifetime in a long time after 4 years, 3 years of drought and good water, and it sucked a lot out of the soil. Let's take a look at a few interesting things here. I like to look at, you know, and this is peas, and this is uptake and removal per bushel, soybeans, canola, and spring wheat. And let's look at phosphorus here, comparing crops. Canola, uptake of about 1.47 pounds per bushel and removal of one. So we'll just talk about some. Potassium, you can see that soybeans take a lot of potassium. Even peas take more potassium. Sulfur, not a surprise. So canola, well, you can smell sulfur coming out of a canola plant driving down the road, so that's not surprising. Calcium, look at the uptake of calcium, but soybeans take up a lot more. I'm surprised that peas don't, because they, you know, they're a big user of calcium. Zinc, if you're growing zinc or peas, you want a lot of zinc, and maybe guys in southern Saskatchewan seem to have a deficiency of zinc. Maybe part of their answer is in both peas and lentils, if they're not getting good yields. But canola takes a lot of zinc. No, everything takes a lot of zinc. Soybeans don't take as much zinc, but they take more manganese, and that's because of the way they handle nitrogen fixation. It's different in soybeans than it is in say, alfalfa and peas and lentils. So they need a lot more manganese to do that job. Copper, you'll notice something interesting in why I throw in copper is because everybody knows that wheat can run into copper issues. Trouble is that canola on a per bushel basis actually takes up more copper. And we explained that in the last video because it's used in electron transport and photosynthesis. Boron, same thing. Canola takes up a lot of boron and it takes a massive amount of iron up. Look at the amount of iron that it takes compared to anything else. So let's take that out. We're growing 20 million acres of canola. Let's just use that. And it's maybe more, but let's just use that. And at 40 bushels, we'll use an average of 40 bushels. That's not unreasonable. That's about 700 million pounds of phosphorus a year, which equates to 350,000 tons of pea a year, leaves in just canola. Never mind what's going on in all of other crops. That's a massive amount. Now, we didn't need to worry about it too much 50 years ago when I started into this agricultural business as an entomologist, because we were growing 17, 18 bushels an acre. We have now doubled that. So the draw on our soil after almost 100 years of farming has never been greater. And the ability of soil to provide that during that growth phase is probably harder than ever for plants, along with the compaction that we've implied on it, the salinity that seems to be increasing, and in some cases, the the acidity problems that are developing. We did a podcast a couple of weeks ago with Ken King, who is the coach for the fellow who won the 100 bushel canola contest that Rob Syke was running. And we pulled some of this together. Take a look at total nutrients that are taking off on 100 bushels of oats, total of macros and micros. So if we want to grow a crop that, you know, and grow 100 bushels that doesn't use much, use grow oats, grow barley, grow 100 bushels of corn, which is in the heck of a lot. We don't use much micro, or we don't use much macro for that matter. What happens when we look at wheat? This is uptake, not removal, but uptake. But a lot of the immobile nutrients that are uptake and wind up in the straw, and the roots were primarily in the upper zones of the soil or on top of the soil and haven't got the ability to be translocated, or not translocated, moved down into the soil profile. So it's all stuck near the top. Wheat. Well, we pull off quite a bit more. Flax, well, we never get 100 bushels of flax, at least I don't think I'll see that in my lifetime, but we could might get 50, so that half of that. So it would put it in the ballpark in terms of pull of this. Canola, massive amount, along with a massive amount of micronutrients relative to everything else we're growing. Peas, a lot of macros, but not so much in micros. So we are pulling, along with this great crop that we grow with the massive root system we talked about that is non-mycorrhizal, that has evolved to extract phosphorus and put its roots in the right place. Phenomenal plant. But it's also taking a lot of nutrients out of our land. And on top of that, it's also a big user of water. On a per bushel basis, it uses more water than peas or wheat or barley. If you want to use these, you can, and you're short of water, you can look at some of these kinds of factors. And Kendall is the expert. I just kind of stole these numbers because I want to make a point that canola is a great crop, but it also has a huge demand on nutrient supply. So these are autotrophs. They don't need anything else but sunlight and nutrients. If we are not giving it its nutrients that it needs to maintain the lifestyle we talked about in the first part of this presentation, you know what? You're never going to get that big crop you're looking for. Everything else can be just fine. Water is going to be your big next one. But we got to start monitoring our fields. We got to start paying attention to what we're depleting, where it is, in a much, much better way as we move forward. When we take a look at this, you know, I'm sick and tired of looking at this slide of pH and telling folks that, you know, yeah, we get all these micros picked up at lower pHs. At higher pHs, we are in a deficiency in some of Saskatchewan, some of our high calcareous soils. We have deficiencies here. We have, you know, pretty good uptake of these under most acid conditions. And then we haven't got moly uptake as pH goes down. And we have all these implications up here for pH affecting phosphorus and tying up with iron and manganese and aluminum at this end, and tying up at this end with calcium and magnesium. So we got this going on. We got stratification taking place, reducing organic matter, the phosphorus dropping, you know, when we get more than 2 inches into the ground because we're not getting those immobile nutrients down. The potassium levels are great down to 2 to 3 inches. Zinc, same thing. All of this is happening. This is an example of stuff I just did here up at Camrose, where I took soil 0 to 3 and take a look at the pH, 5.9, 3 to 6, 6.5, 6 to 12, 7. Well, this is approaching an area, and that's 0 to 3, so in the top inch and a half, it's probably worse. Zinc levels as we go down, same thing. Manganese levels as we go down, just like that chart showed that Elston produced years ago. It is real, folks. If you don't believe it, go out and do the same thing in your own field. So these very immobile nutrients, including phosphorus, copper, iron, manganese, and zinc, with these irons and along with phosphorus, even if you pull them out of the plant, they're not going to get back down into the soil profile at all. These will move down, so you can pull those out and leave it in the straw, and it'll move down for sure. And these will be in between. So when you're thinking about your fertility package, we have to start thinking about where we're placing these, when we're placing them, what form are we putting them? Can we drag it out over the growing season so it's available and not tied up? And we got to take a look at, you know, this issue of mass flow. If we start running into deficiency, drought, this mass flow is going to change, and plants are going to have more and more trouble getting these nutrients, and they're going to have more and more trouble by diffusion, because diffusion takes water as well, and all they're going to be doing is having to grow roots and bump into these guys that don't move at all, to speak of. So water is the key. And providing that water and nutrient is the key to growing roots and growing the plant. So we got to start taking this into consideration. I'm not going to go any further, because I know Elston has done a lot of presentations on crop intelligence perspective, on behalf, I should say, and has covered this multiple times. Mass flow, we talked about earlier. So as we said earlier as well, just as a bit of a review of the last episode, NPK and MAG can be remobilized from these leaves as they kill the leaves and move them up. All these have to be moved by the roots through, because if they're stuck here, they can't move them up here. That means as fall comes on, as roots go deeper, as it runs out of water, you're going to be running into a stress issue with these nutrients. And I'm going to talk about these nutrients in terms of how important they are for stress management. It is a dilemma we're facing, and you may be stuck putting on foliar nutrients in order to carry these plants through this stressful period, because they can't get it from the soil. And the only way you're going to know is if you're tissue testing. If you're not soil testing and tissue testing, and I believe in the end seed testing, you're not going to have a clue whether you're getting a benefit for your inputs or not, and how much that benefit is, and whether the plants are getting it. So here's what happens. The plant picks up nutrients in the water flow here through the root, where we got a water column that's continuous. As I said, as the air moves in, we get less and less ability to pull that water. So as we go down, we have smaller air space, pore spaces. We can't grow as big a roots, basically. And roots follow old root channels. So that's why things like clovers and alfalfas are great, because those old root channels go down deep, and then the other roots will follow the easiest pattern and go down deep. So that's the dilemma you face, is you can get diffusion, but as the air spaces increase, you can't get water to the roots. It's almost that simple. Now, I'm going to just switch, and I'm going to take a stab, and I might not be successful at taking the stab because I'm not a water expert, but somebody's got to talk about how water actually works. So we're going to talk about osmotic movement of solvents across a membrane, because all the cells are a membrane. And what it tells you is that the movement of a solvent, which in this case is water, across a semi-permeable membrane, which is the plasma membrane, towards a higher concentration of solutes, a lower concentration of solvent. That's what osmotic pressure is. And that's what's responsible for growing the plant. It's responsible for bringing water from the soil into the plant. It's also involved in guard cell promotion and active transport. So here's my feeble attempt that I picked up from a book. If we have a non-saline soil, we haven't got a lot of salts here. There's more salts that are in the root, so the water is attracted into the root, and whether that be a seed or a root, it's attracted and pulled in. And then by transpiration, it is moved up. When you have a lot of salt, salinity, and those can be calcium chloride, magnesium sulfate, can be sulfates and chlorides that have moved and concentrated because of water flow and then drying and wetting, you have a lot of salts here, more water in the tissue, and in fact, almost nothing moving in, or in fact, the soil pulling the moisture out. That's what osmosis is about. So when you get those saline soils, the plant cannot get water and as a result can't get nutrients. There can be all kinds of nutrients there, but it can't get them. So the plant dies. It's just that simple. And because of it's basically dying from drought in the shoot, the plant closes its stomata, in fact, to try and prevent loss of water because it can't bring up any more and is struggling. It amplifies the whole problem. Now we can't get CO2 in, we can't get anything going, and you're on a downhill spiral. And as the salinity increases and broadens, your issue is going to get worse. I can't talk about how to solve it. We're going to have a podcast coming up in the future with Les Henry, and hopefully that'll help us solve this problem. Okay, so anyhow, let's go on. We got issues around us, and let's not be negative, but let's put it bluntly. Farmers have to start monitoring and have to start taking action now or as soon as possible on a field-by-field basis to solve some of these problems. So we're going to talk about oxidative stress, because almost all the stress that occurs in the plant, it's not total, but it's the one we can manage, I think, is due to oxidation or the process where oxygen is damaged. So what's the process and where? What's the damage and how do plants respond? That's simple stuff. So what is stress? Any environmental condition that prevents the plant from reaching its full genetic potential. Well, that's everything. Water, temperature, nutrient distribution, nutrient balance. It's in somebody's hands. The plant's doing its best, I can tell you that much. It's genetically struggling to do that. We got to help it by putting those nutrients in there, managing to keep water where it falls, keep it from running away, moving salts and becoming and creating saline issues. Oxidative stress, and I put this in writing so that you can remember it, reflects an imbalance between the systemic production of these reactive oxygen species, damaged oxygen, because all organisms using oxygen, including us, do that, and the biological system's ability to readily detoxify the reactive intermediates or to repair the resulting damage. So it's a balance. Homeostasis, remember that word from the very first slide I gave you. So why are they produced? These are generated in the cells because of electrons leaking during photosynthesis and respiration. Photosynthesis in the chloroplasts, respiration in the mitochondria. Too much sun, not enough water. Excess reactive oxygen species are produced. And the easiest way to solve it within the plant is to remove the stress on the plant system, resulting in reduction on ROS. Now, some of you guys are under stress. People tell you, don't be so stressed. How easy is that to do? And we have the opportunity to do something about it because we can think. The plant can't move, so it's not so easy to remove that stress. The plant can do its best, but without the materials to handle it, it's stuck. So it's up to us as farmers to provide that plant with what it needs if it can't get it. If we've depleted the soil of those nutrients, if we haven't managed the water, I mean, in many cases, we're stuck. We can't manage water. We can't make it out of the sky, but we can make it more efficient. We can store it better, and you've done that. The biggest progress that I've seen in all my time on the prairies is the movement to minimum tillage. Minimum tillage conserved water. Genetics gave us plant power. That combination got us to where we are from 20 bushel canola 50 years ago or 17 to 40, 50, 60, 70, 85, and 100. Now, how are we going to get to the next step? So what is a free radical or reactive oxygen species? It's a place where an electron is lost from the outer circle of that element. Well, how do we deal with that? We have antioxidants. You've heard that term, antioxidants, which will give that electron back and make everybody happy. So we have a way of antioxidants. And when we think of it as human beings, and you hear that term antioxidants, what do we think of? Oh, we think of blueberries. We think of lycopene in tomatoes. We think of lycopene in watermelons. We talk of blackberries and what are the phytochemicals in there. Those antioxidants are what we as humans eat to solve our problem and what the plants use to solve their problem. And then we eat them to get it from them. It's a really cool system. So what causes these reactive oxygen species? And these are them. These are hydroxyl peroxide. And peroxide is one I can talk about because, as I was a kid, we never had much for antibiotics back when I was small. So whenever you cut yourself, you put some peroxide on it and it would fuzz. And it was actually taking oxygen molecules from microbes and from my tissue and killing it, actually, so it would prevent infection. So drought and water deficit causes them, air pollution, salinity, heavy metals, biotic stresses, light intensity and high temperature. Everything causes stress if it's too much. Same with us. If your bank account is too low, it causes stress. If you're in due to with your wife or girlfriend or whatever, causes stress. So water stress is one of the worst because it causes the stomata to close. You don't get CO2 coming in. We get problems in photosynthesis. And we have reactive oxygen species having to be scavenged. Otherwise, we don't get growth. And when we get too much of it, we get a growth adjustment and we get stress adaption if we handle it, not get too much of it. If we don't handle it, we get damage. And here's the dilemma. Movement of water and photosynthesis is a struggle between CO2 and water. When we close the stomata to save water, we prevent CO2 from coming in. By preventing CO2 from coming in, we shut down photosynthesis and the production of photosynthates. And as a result, the whole plant shuts down. Nothing can happen. And as that lasts and that lasts, it's okay for a short period because the plant can get rid of these things. But as it lasts and lasts, the damage gets worse and harder to repair. So here's simplistically what we've been talking about. We have in the chloroplast, in the mitochondria, in the peroxisome, we have damage that occurs from abiotic stress. Produces these reactive oxygen species, and we get oxidative damage. And what is oxidative damage? Well, when we get these free radicals, what they do is they attack the lipids in the membranes. Remember that blue plasma membrane, it's got lipids in between the phosphorus little blue dots. It chews through that, and when that happens, it can lead to cell death. We get DNA damage. Those molecules damage the DNA. We get chlorosis damaging in there, so it's affecting and killing the chloroplast, and we get chlorosis, and we get protein damage. We get a lot of damage, and honestly, folks, the same thing happens in us. We get oxidative damage in us in a big way, and our body handles it the same way. And just to show you again, here's the mitochondria. We get oxygen that's damaged. Here we get oxygen that's damaged in the chloroplast, and we get oxygen that's damaged here in the peroxisomes. And then we get that all converted to hydrogen peroxide as best we can, and hydroxyls, and we try to break it down. If we don't break it down, we get membrane damage. But if we go over here and we use what are called salts, and I'll talk about those, we can get that changed into, that moves around. We can get these turned into oxygen. And these hydrogens here can be handled by catalase. So we can deal with those if we have the right tools. And this is just showing you that electron transport that was taking place when we get the movement of electrons. And we need this movement, otherwise we're not going to get photosynthesis because we move it to a higher level of activity And we have that plasticine with copper in here. We got the ferredoxin with the iron in here. And let's just show you now. No CO2, low water, electron transport and photosystems, main source of our reactive oxygen species. So here we go. We get damage here. We get damage there. We get rubisco that is damaged. We get oxygen that's damaged here in the electron transport, and we get iron in a superoxide dismutase, which breaks it down and gives us oxygen and hydrogen peroxide, which then is broken down by these enzymes and other materials into water. There you go. Electron transport chain is managed by these products. And I'm going to tell you what they are in a minute. So how do plants respond? Our role in the response. Same as they do to everything. Environmental stress, perception of the signal, transcription control in the genes. We get a stress response in this case with mostly osmoprotectants, detoxification, water movement, and chaperones. I'm not going to have time to, well, I can talk about chaperones a bit. And revival of cellular homeostasis, and we get tolerance. So it's looking at the stress, it's checking the damage, it's producing things, and it's figuring out what to do. It transcribes them, makes things to help it, and it's damaged. So here we go. And you can read this if you want, but we have this in the chloroplast, the mitochondria, and the peroxisome, as well as other places, but these are the major ones. And we get the ROS types, the reactive oxygen species here. We get the enzymatic scavengers, which we are showing you the sods and so on here. And then we get the non-enzymatic scavengers. So it's got both the cofrils and prolines, and now we're going to talk about those individually. In this slide, or my glasses. Basically it covers it all. So here's plant defense mechanism. Let's look at the antioxidants. Ascorbate, you may recognize that. That's vitamin C. Glutathione, it's a sulfur compound. Tocopherol, vitamin E. Carotenoids, the colors in all those berries and plants. Those are the antioxidants that give that electron to those free radicals to make them happy. The enzymatic ones are all of these things, catalase, a superoxide dismutase, and a bunch of other ones I won't get into, but these enzymes scavenge them. We have these become compatible solutes which go into the cells, and they're molecules that allow the plant to keep water in the cell because these are all low molecular weight materials. Proline, oops, whoa. Sorry about that. I just hit my mouse here in excitement as I move forward. Proline is an amino acid, so that's easy. Glycine is a nitrogen product along with betaines. Sugars are sugars, and these are alcohols, and this is a hormone. These accumulate in the cells as a protective mechanism to keep water in and also to scavenge those free radicals. We have a whole pile of hormones that come into play, abscisic acid, gibberellins, auxins, ethylene, jasmonic acid, brassinosteroids, and so on. And we get homeostasis again. These are all produced biosynthetically from the nutrients, the minerals, the water that we get through genetic systems that make these things and are upregulated in response to reception of signals in the plasma membrane. So let's take a look at what these are made of here. That's just another example. Carotenoids, those are those colors. Proline, vitamin E, ascorbate, glutathione. Elston takes glutathione to make himself look young all the time because it's a heck of an antioxidant. And then we get the enzymes, superoxide dismutase and ascorbic and so on. And I'll talk to you about them. They're not that complicated. I can understand it. So here we go. We got a plant. And I'm going to talk about these osmolites, first of all, because those are one of the key ones. All this affected, we get oxidative stress, and it produces all of these osmolites to fortify the cell, accumulate them in the cell. And proline is one very, very common one. It can go in and it quenches, or in other words, it also scavenges these reactive oxygen species, and we get active stress tolerance. So that's the first thing they do. Now here where the notes are, you know, I spend a lot of time getting you here, and the answers are actually quite simple. Here's what superoxide dismutase is, and don't worry about these words. I mean, it's an enzyme that takes these and it breaks it down to hydrogen peroxide, which is less toxic than these free radicals here. This is then broken down by another enzyme called catalase to produce water. So that's a good thing. So it's manganese in the mitochondria, which we saw. It's iron in the chloroplast, which I showed you. The zinc and copper combine together because the zinc cannot change its valence. So it's just a partner with the copper, and the copper does the activity in the chloroplast and in the cytosol. And we saw the role of copper, angrin, and manganese in the last presentation, manganese in breaking the water molecule, electron transport, and here in the cytosol doing stuff. And there is now a new nickel sod, which I can't find anything about, but it is also there. So these micronutrients that are becoming scarcer and scarcer, and what we saw in the seed are being reduced, are the key ones in terms of stress management in the cells. And I showed you this before. Zinc is down, manganese is down once I get past the three inch level. You know, this is not a good thing. Potassium is down. We saw that already. Next, we're going to go on to sulfur. Sulfur has a big role in this. Now, this Mulder's chart, you know, nobody noticed that sulfur isn't in there for the last 50 years until one day somebody noticed that. But sulfur doesn't interfere with anything. Now, I'll move this here. Oh. That over there. Okay, now here's sulfate. A plant can't use sulfate, by the way, just like it can't use nitrate. It converts nitrate to ammonium and then uses sulfate. Has to be converted to sulfide through a reduction process. And here's a good example, you know, from the other presentation. These are transporters here in the vacuole, which takes excess sulfate and puts it into vacuole to store it so it's safe. And that happens with all the nutrients. Then it moves it along, sulfide, and then it's incorporated into an amino acid called cysteine. Now, from cysteine, the plant makes methionine, which is key in formation of all proteins, because the start of a protein in the ribosome always starts with methionine, which is a sulfur compound. And one day, if we have time, I can explain that to you if you really want to know. Put that question down for Friday. But more importantly, it's glutathione. And you've seen glutathione show up in my slides already. Glutathione is the sulfur compound that is circulated in the system of plants as the first responder and a signal of the amount of sulfur in the plant. And what glutathione does is works with ascorbic acid in what's called the ascorbate glutathione pathway. And we can see ascorbate listed here, glutathione, ascorbate, vitamins here. That whole combination runs our oxidation reduction process that scavenges those free radicals. Really, really key. Works against stress. Sulfur does a whole lot of things in the plant. You can look at that. And we know that canola takes a massive amount of it up there. Not surprising. Very good at dealing with stress, man. That plant, it uses it. And methionine is key for the formation of things like those glycine betaines, those osmolates, the polyamines, which are hormones, ethylene itself. So what it comes down to is all these nutrients have roles. Nobody talks to you about all these roles. But when the plant doesn't have it, those roles are compromised. Glutathione is an important antioxidant in plants and animals. And I talked about the cycle. And take a look at the results of 2020's summary for ANL's 2020 summary of lab results. 78% of samples, soil samples from Western Canada, show low sulfur. Now, it's not surprising. Sulfur is extremely variable in the soil profile. So, you know, a lot of times you would say, well, geez, how reliable are they? And when we talk about canola, we say, just put it on because we know canola will use a lot of it. So you have to be careful in terms of evaluating sulfur levels because it's sort of a tricky one because of that variability. But I want to show you a couple more slides. If you look at Eastern Canada, for Eastern Canada, you know, 73% of samples are very low in sulfur now, 43% in phosphorus, 55% boron. And in the tissues, phosphorus deficiency, sulfur deficiency, boron deficiency. Not so good. So sulfur deficiency, but take a look at this. Remember the days, some of you guys are old enough to remember the days of acid rain in 1990? This was acid rain in eastern United States. 10 years later, down to this, down to this, down to this, and now we're putting sulfur down in eastern Canada, eastern North America, because we cleaned up our sulfur deposits and the plants are now suffering from it. Anyhow, interesting story. We can change things pretty fast. We don't always know what the ramifications are, but we can do it. Potassium. I think we're getting close to the end. Out of all the minerals, potassium plays a particular critical role in plant growth and metabolism and contributes greatly to the survival of plants under various abiotic stresses. Key in stomatal closure. Key in root growth and cell growth and expansion and osmotic pressure in the plant that keeps the plant turgid, keeps water in there, keeps expanding cells. Key roles, enzyme activation, protein synthesis, photosynthesis, osmoregulation, what I just talked about, stomatal movement, just talked about, energy transfer, phloem transport, same thing, cation and ion balance. Just if you want to look at it, here, improved ROS balance, in published data, all this kind of stuff. And we get potassium uptake, and this is peas. And you'll almost always see a bit of a decline here because what happens, you get some of that leached out late in the season, and some of it will be exuded back into the rooting zone once it's finished doing its job. That's contrary to phosphorus, which continues to go up at a gradual pace until the plant dies. The last thing the plant does takes phosphorus. And here we go at Western Canada, just to remind you again about potassium. We don't have anything showing up here in Western Canada. And yet I see tons and tons of tissue tests showing potassium low in seed samples. And I'm surprised to see this because I see potassium levels low. It's a matter of, I guess, when it's taking, but I can't argue with those, but I would be checking potassium for sure. And lastly, zinc. Take a look at this map. Elston pulled it up years ago. Southwestern Saskatchewan, almost all of southern Saskatchewan is pretty close to deficient in zinc. So in the end, ladies and gentlemen, this process is key to produce all of this. Everything that the plant needs and biosynthesizes from this little process and this sugar, along with the nutrients you give it. Is it no wonder that we have this, considering that acidity is getting worse, salinity is getting worse, We're drying down nutrients at a faster pace than we've ever done. Our yields are better than ever, but there's a cost to that. And water is critical for this to occur. If we want to do something, we got to help these plants. We got to make sure we get balanced and we get homeostasis. And here's my final slide. The plants know what to do. They've been programmed for millions of years in what to do. Genetically, they're there. And I should tell you at this point in time, on a global basis, there's a massive movement to find genes to put into plants that will deal with these issues, because they are global issues. Salinity is a global issue. Acidity is a global issue. And it's affecting us, starting to affect us, and is affecting things like clubroot and Echinomyces, because acid soils are much more prone to those diseases. So we are still learning a lot. There's a lot to be learned, but the geneticists are working on putting in all kinds of genes from all kinds of plants. So we're going to see transgenics maybe be an answer, like we're trying to get endophytes to actually fix nitrogen, and they can do those. They're free-living rhizobium bacteria that live in the air spaces in cells and between cells. Sorry, not in cells, between cells. Some of them maybe are forming somewhat symbiotic relationships. Do your best. Do one field at a time. Learn. Be aware. Change your thinking about how you're farming and looking at your plants. Try new things. Try yourself. Find out on your own land and monitor your fields now. Because I think in many cases, we're getting away with things that if we continue on this path, we're going to find out that one day we're going to come to a dead end. Right now, we know that, or we believe, that phosphorus levels globally are available from mining, mostly in Morocco, for probably 50 to 100 years. Taurus is extracting that from garbage, from human waste, instead of it going into the ocean and into the rivers. And we're going to extract more of it. But there are limitations to what we can do if we don't start recycling some of this stuff and start changing it. And if we do that, if we just pick up, get rid of our acidity, we will expose the uptake of a lot of nutrients that are now tied up by acid soils. The cost, the question is not the cost, because it's going to be expensive. The question is, what's the long-term benefit? Anyhow, enough preaching for today. Hope that gives you a new perspective. And that's the end of the presentation. Thanks a lot. And we'll hear from you on our open line coming up in a couple of days. Thanks a lot.
Beautiful. Thanks, Mike.
Jesus, it's going to be interesting to see how much shit I'm going to get for bitching about how farmers are farming. God darn it, you know what? I'm tired of pussyfooting around and, you know, appeasing them. Jesus, you know, maybe you just got to tell them, you guys, you know, you're going to have to change your act.
I mean, I think our audience will be as receptive to that message as anybody. I would agree. We all placate their egos so much.
You know, and logistics always outdoes agronomics is the common. Well, you know what? Give me a break. If you use attitude,